Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can everyone hear me okay? Thank you. Welcome to Wollongong Local Planning Panel. My name is Robert Montgomery. I'm the chair of the panel this afternoon. A little bit about my background. I'm a town planner. Have some 38 years' experience in local government, state government and private practice. I also sit on two other panels in Sydney, and I've also appointed as alternate chairs to two other panels in Sydney. I'll just ask each of the other panel members to introduce themselves, and then we'll move through the agenda.
Brendan. I'm Brendan Randalls. I'm an architect. I've been a panel member for, I think, about 10 years. I'm on numerous panels throughout Sydney, design review panels. I'm an architect as well as an urban designer.
Thank you, Sue.
I'm an environmental horticultural expert and I deal on panels. I'm on a number of panels in the Sydney region and I deal with issues relating to site vegetation management, tree management, ecological management, landscape design and environmental impacts on the landscape.
And Bernard?
I've lived in the area for the past 28 years. So I'm the community rep. I come from a construction background for over more than 40 years, unfortunately.
Okay. This panel is a panel constituted under the Environmental Planning and Assessment Act. And the purpose of the panel is to provide a public hearing, an opportunity for members of the public to be heard about issues of concern, and also to make independent decisions. Decisions independent of the council on certain development applications. There's four items on the agenda tonight. The panel has inspected the sites this afternoon, so we're familiar with the sites and surrounds, and we've also read the submissions that you may have made to the council during the period of notification. How the meeting will work is that we'll hear from submitters first, and then the applicant's representatives will follow for each item. Speakers are allowed a maximum of 5 minutes, and this is timed by the council staff, so you'll hear a sound at 5 minutes, and if you haven't finished when you hear that sound, you'll need to sort of wrap up fairly quickly. We'll often give the applicants and their representatives a little longer. Don't be concerned about that. We do that because we expect them to respond to the issues that you may raise before they speak. The meeting is audio recorded for the public record, so when I call your name and you come to speak, I'll ask you to sit at the table at the front and speak clearly into the microphone to make sure that your comments are recorded. I'd also ask you to show respect to other speakers by listening in silence when others are speaking. And following the public meeting tonight, the panel will adjourn to deliberate. Our decisions will be published on the council's website generally within 3 working days, so that's how you can access the decisions. Just before we start, I'll ask each panel member whether they have any conflict of interest to declare. Bernard?
No.
Sue?
Yes, I have what might reasonably be perceived as a conflict of interest in relation to item 2, 9 Crown Lane. I was a member of Wollongong Design Review Panel that actually met with the applicant on several occasions and made recommendations in relation to the various design iterations that led to the final design.
So when we get to item 2, Sue will excuse herself from the room and wait patiently outside until we're ready for the next item. I don't have any conflicts of interest. Brendan?
I don't have conflicts.
Thank you. Okay, well, we'll start with item 1, 56 Princess Highway, Bulleye. I don't have any speakers registered for this matter. Is there anybody here that wishes to speak on this matter? No? Okay, well, we'll move straight on to item 2. Thanks, Sue. Item 2 is a proposal for a boarding house on 9 Crown Lane, Wollongong. I don't have any registered submitters. Are there any people here who came tonight to speak in relation to this that may not have registered? No? Okay. Well, I have Mr. Peter Rasa for the applicant who's here to... Where is he? There he is. Here to answer questions. I think we will, so perhaps, Mr. Rasa, if you can just take a seat. If that blue light's not on the microphone, just press the button and it should come on. Thank you. Brendan, you had some questions,
yes.
I think.
Peter, I was just wondering... is my own microphone? Yes, sir. Yes, the design review panel were wondering about the northwest corner of the building and its resolution between the public domain in this regard. Am I on the right matter? Is this item two?
Yeah.
And at the moment, what you've presented, it has some streets coming up from the footpath on the northern side, but it's quite unclear the resolution of this part of the plan. I'm sorry, the northwest part of the plan here.
That's where the road widening is.
Yes. Could you tell us something about the status of the road widening, like when it's going to occur? And what was your intention, that paving comes across onto your part of the site? Or?
Yeah.
And what about the levels? Like there are stairs on one side and then there's a small return. Yes. So it's a very important part of the site. So. I think somehow we're going to have to address that in how we respond to the design so that we can know what the design intent is. Because at the moment it's looking as though it'll just... Yes. Yes, we know that too. It's just this part of the design that's quite vague at the moment, probably for reasons relating to process. So that was one matter I wanted to raise, Peter. We don't have enough time to resolve it now. Another matter is the use of a Luca bond. A lot of people in the industry are nervous about using this kind of panel because its potential for flammability and so forth. And a lot of certifiers don't want to certify this material. And I think that might have something to do with not the fact that it's the Luca bond product, but the fact that it's often replaced during the process with a cheaper product. It does make us worry. It does concern us. So is it the right material to be suggesting because of the risk of that further down the track there? Well, that's what I mean. I'm just wondering if, like I actually design buildings and I'm working these days with a large commercial firm, they won't use it because of the potential issues. Like we're now getting audited about building materials we've used, and I just wonder if there might be a better material to use to avoid this potential conflict.
Yeah.
third issue I was concerned about is the distances to the fire stairs. Is that a fire engineered solution, or is that a complying solution, or like the communal rooms right up here, the fire stairs up here?
Yeah, the dual fire stairs.
Right. Would this be called a...
It could be a fire engineered solution, if necessary.
See, the panel don't want to be in a situation where a building is approved and then you discover that you have to redesign it because of distance.
No, we don't, because we've allocated that smoke there anyway. So
is that under specific advice? Have you got a fire report? Right. Okay, and there was one, there were just some other, the stair actually on the corner, this is quite a prominent corner, it's the corner on the northeast side of the building, and there's an egress stair coming up from, that's right. I'm just wondering, you've put a wall there that's a fat wall, it's like a feature wall. Do you think you could put the stair in the wall, make the wall fatter, and make it like it's a feature of the wall, you know, that the stair comes up in the wall? Because you can see that is actually a right of way that you have to drive around. This thing seems to creep right into it like that. Couldn't it be that you make that just a fat wall and the stair come up in the wall so that you still get the benefit of the... So you still have your feature wall, but it doesn't have that fire stair poking out of it? Just looks awkward, that's all. Yeah, I think you can do it. You just come out like that and go up like that, and that whole thing's your wall. Yes. The last thing was some of the rooms seem to be smaller than 12 square metres. And I think 12 square metres is the minimum size room allowed for a boarding house. So we'll identify those rooms, and either as a condition or whatever way Robert chooses, we'll ask you to just assess the rooms and make sure they're 12 square metres.
Okay. Bernard?
No.
You didn't have anything? No. I think the reason for the room size is that there's a lot of misconception in the community about boarding houses being places which are less than desirable to have nearby. And we know as professionals that there's a demand and a very much a need for those sort of developments. And the last thing we want to do is be creating them with substandard rooms, so it just enhances people's concerns about them. All right,
okay.
Thank you for that. Is there anything that you wanted to say, Mr. Russa?
Yes, I do. We'll make comments about it. It was more the case, it wasn't clear how the junction, look at the size of the plan, it's very small, but how all of this comes together, you know, and it's very important because you've got a large building there and it's a very intense corner, so we want it to be good.
And I guess that, once we get those five levels, that might evolve a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay. Yes, okay. All right, thanks
very much. That concludes item two. Lauren, unless Sue can hear me, could you go and find Sue, please? Ask her to come back. Okay, we'll move on to item three, which is 11 Catherine Street, Quinville. This is a matter that's referred from a previous panel back to this panel. I don't have any residents registered to speak, any submitters registered. Is there anyone here who wishes to speak who didn't register? No? Okay. Well, we have from the applicant, the architect, Mr. DiMartino, the owners, Messrs. Kostovsky, and Mr. Blazewski, and also Elaine Triglown, town planner. So I'm assuming that we're going to hear from Ms. Triglown and just Mr. DiMartino. I can hear you, but okay, it's not working.
I can't turn mine off. There's no button.
Maybe that one should be the one for the public. No, just change them over. Just give that one to Angela.
Oh, that's good. So you can't speak now.
Oh, you frightened me.
I'd take that as a compliment.
Can you hear me now? Oh,
now it's too loud. Okay. So the matter was before the panel previously. I was unable to attend at that time. The panel made some recommendations, and when I got back, we attended to responding and making the amendments where we could. So the primary amendments that we made responded directly to redesigning the front dwelling, Unit 1, to address the street. We essentially made it look more like a single dwelling with a garage, a front door, courtyard, addressing the street and removing the visitor space from within the front setback. So that were two big pluses that were recommended by yourselves. The other modification was the levels between units 2 and 3, just to even them out a little bit and make the driveway a little bit less steep. So we did that as well to improve pedestrian amenity in that area. And the big one, I guess, was the one of the options the panel wanted us to look at was whether it was possible to flip the whole development or mirror reverse it, if you like. We did look at that. We sought some advice from our arborist, Warwick, who's here tonight. Overall, we thought that the impact was, or I guess the outcome would be better if it remained the same. And I outlined a few reasons why that would be the case. You know, there were a couple of reasons. Primarily, one of them was that the tree would actually be better protected if it remained, the driveway remained on the, the southwestern side. One of the reasons we redesigned the front dwelling the way we did was to actually move or have the opportunity to move the driveway a little bit further away from the tree as well, which I know was one of Sue's concerns previously, that perhaps we were a little bit too close to the tree, but I can say that the arborist was comfortable and is even happier now that we are a little bit further away from the tree. And by mirror reversing the proposal, we think that the buildings would be a lot closer to the tree, and the tree would then be in someone's courtyard, and that would pose issues potentially down the track. Also, mirror reversing the proposal would also impact on the private open space. So in the sense that at the moment there's a single-storey building on our boundary. If we were mirror reverse the proposal, the building on the boundary would actually be two-storey, and it's actually closer to the boundary when we looked at the survey than the single-storey building actually on the eastern boundary. So we made a judgment to not mirror reverse it, but we made all the other changes that were suggested, and I think correctly so, for the betterment of the development, particularly the visitor space.
Thank you. Ms. Triglown, did you want to add anything? I mean, I think it's fair to say that the panel on reviewing the amended plans, I think we've agreed that it's a, it's a much better outcome than the previous previous design, particularly in relation to Unit 1 addressing the street and moving the visitor space. I mean, that was a big, pretty big ask, quite frankly, and you've managed to do that, so we're quite pleased about that. And also the driveway that you've now got a continuous less than or equal to 1 in 14 grade, which I think we all feel much happier about, mm-hmm. that anyone living in one of the end units can quite comfortably walk to the letterbox or wherever else they need to go. So I think we're quite satisfied with that. We are just looking at Unit 1 and looking at the possibility of conditioning it to include the front common open space at the front, to include that actually in the private open space of Unit 1, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't have any objection to that?
No, that'd be
good. Because I think that'd be
improvement.
It'd be an improvement, mm-hmm. and it'd mean that that unit would then actually...
Have a bit of a yard or some landscaping.
Have a decent-sized yard, have a street frontage, and also it'd be much better for passive surveillance because mm-hmm. you'd be looking at the street from the living room.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, any other questions? No?
Oh, I just have a couple.
Your wish came true. Yeah.
Not quite. I noticed that you've put the letterboxes in the landscape plan up under the tree.
Oh.
Yeah.
Look, we can relocate them to the opposite side. That's fine.
Yes, and you just have to make sure that they're for everyone, not in the private open space that we're proposing.
They'll be on the western side of the entry floor.
I just think that would be sensible, and it would also be easier for the residents to.
Yeah, why have any footing there when you don't need to? Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Yep.
The other issue that was pointed out to us is that there's a solid roof on Unit 1 on its northern elevation that will interfere with solar access to that unit.
I'm not sure about that. The courtyard's only partly covered, and that's just to allow some cover to that outdoor space.
We don't have an issue with that. What we're proposing is that you look at putting it as a louvered cover so that it can be opened in winter to improve solar access during winter, so that you can make it shady in summer and warmer in winter. Will there be an issue with that?
Would like to suggest that perhaps we could extend the cover then to cover the whole courtyard if that was the case, because... Yes.
Just let me... Well, anyhow, will you have an issue with... If we'll look at that. If you want it to be extended, I'll just check it and
yeah, if the pergola or whatever you're suggesting is the operable roof, if that could be extended to the to cover the whole courtyard, then that would be acceptable.
Yeah, because we're just concerned about getting acceptable solar access during winter, you understand.
Mm.
So that one. And then I just wanted to check, because we did ask questions in relation to the earlier proposal about the deep soil zone at the rear, which whether it could be a communal area or not. I see it's just proposed to plant it out with shrubs and trees. Did you explore the option of making it a...
I wasn't aware of that recommendation, to be honest. It didn't come up in the notes. I wasn't here.
No, I know.
I didn't. So, but look, the issue there is it's a deep soil zone, and council's policy is to plant...
Get trees.
It's only 4 apartments. I think communal space is not required until 10.
We're aware of that. I was just checking whether you... Anyhow, okay. So
I'd like to keep it deep soil zone if... That was okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thanks. Sue, Brendan?
I think afterwards I'll have a
discussion with the panel members. It's just about in terms of that issue about getting optimising Sun to Unit 1.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just make sure that our recommendation is...
you know what to that's fine. Yep. We've only covered... So all the courtyards are only partially covered at the moment to allow both shade and sun.
In that situation, I've actually put a skylight over a porch as well. As another alternative.
Look, the way people do entertain or enjoy their outdoor space today is undercover, particularly in summer when it, you know, in the middle of the day when it's very hot, they put an umbrella up. So perhaps, something... to the effect of, something that's flexible or a skylight to that end, that's fine.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That concludes item 3. Okay, we'll move on to item 4, which is a proposed mixed-use residential development at 39 Angel Street. This is another matter which has come back to the panel after being previously considered. I have a number of submitters registered to speak. The first person is Mr. Nick Irwin. Again, I'll just remind you that all speakers have 5 minutes and we'd ask you to stick within that. And also, if a speaker before you has raised the same issue that you're going to talk about, there's no need to repeat the same issues because the panel takes on each of the issues that are raised. And we really would like to hear from each submitter how this development is going to impact on their amenity, not so much necessarily a broader thing. So, as I say, you're entitled to use your 5 minutes to say what you like effectively, but there's no benefit in actually repeating what's already been said. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me speak this evening. I'd like to talk about the traffic concern on Angel Street in the traffic study. The traffic in the narrow part of the street is a concern for the pedestrians and cars. I believe that it was an adequate time period to assess the full traffic patterns and numbers of trips that are used on Angel Street. A 1 week period in August, the 24th, the 8th to the 30th, 8th, I don't believe is long enough. A winter period suppressed traffic flows as there's no daylight savings and trips to the beach and trips, whatever, in an extra 3 hours, 4 hours of light. So there was no counters placed at Yule Street intersection and Caroline Street intersection, which they were saying most of the flow of the traffic goes out to the highway. Given this did not happen, the credibility of the traffic study must be put under scrutiny. A significant amount of residents use Yule Avenue and Caroline Streets to go to the Coromel Shops or the distributor, as the intersection at Angel Street is a black spot. The intersection between Angel Street and the Prince's Highway is a black spot because you come over the hill and there's been numerous accidents on that T section. So, table 2 of the report, speed sections were done at the intersection, so a proper speed study couldn't be accurate because when you enter both intersections, you'd only go at 30 k's an hour. And the one at the intersection, the Princes Highway and Angel Street, it's been cut so they don't speed around the corner. So the traffic monitoring photos were taken when there had no parked cars on the street down towards 39 Angel Street, which gives a false indication as units have three visitor parking spots and residents, visitors would park on the streets. And there's a unit block which is only, well, 15 metres, 20 metres away, which visitors already park on the streets. Hence, I believe it's a traffic concern. So according to the traffic study, the maximum traffic is every car every 30 seconds on Angel Street. In the narrow parts of Angel Street, 3,000 cars per day would not be possible, as this would be a highway or a main road. Thus, no traffic lights at the intersection of Angel Street and Princess Highway. So there's no footpaths for pedestrians, for the people with prams, the elderly, dog walkers, children with bikes, which use the road because there's no footpath to ride their bikes. And a car every 30 seconds is a hazard to pedestrians, which is a safety concern. I did not see provisions for a pedestrian study in the traffic plans. A vehicle every 30 seconds on Angel Street would be disastrous. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next speaker is Mr. Marco Fligo. Can you tell us what you're handing us?
Documents from the developer. Documents the developer asked me to sign.
Okay. Yep.
And then the second piece of paper is the recommendation from my lawyer before I signed it.
So these documents are unsigned. Is that because they haven't been signed or because...
No.
Are they going to be signed or...? Tell us all about it.
Yeah, you understand after my speech.
I am the owner of 28 Angel Street, Corrimal, which is directly opposite the proposed development on 39 Angel Street. Previously, when this went to the panel, I had been in discussions with John Molnar, a developer, to discuss the impact this development will have on my house. One of those impacts was the headlights of cars from 70 bedrooms shining into my bedroom window and living room. My bedroom is directly opposite the proposed driveway. I presented the document which he asked me to sign at the previous panel meeting after numerous conversations with John. I had my lawyer look over it and ask for final changes to be made before I signed it. I have made several attempts right after the first panel meeting and this past week to have the document completed and signed. He has completely ignored my emails and calls since the first panel meeting on the 15th of August. I have not heard from John in over 4 months. Today he contacted me 4 hours prior to the panel meeting. I tried to get this agreement signed and completed 4 months ago. My house is the most affected in Angel Street. I am directly opposite the development. All I want is assurances that development will remain how the designs are, which include the screens and mature trees near the entrance driveway and the bins to never be moved onto the street. If the council denies the planted trees and increased height of the fences, then I ask the development to cover the cost of installation and maintenance of screens in my house. I have printed the last document his lawyer presented me to sign, and I also have printed the notes for my lawyer to make the changes before I sign it. This is my only way of limiting the impact on my house. I want to make it clear I have not signed the document. I am still waiting for my lawyer's conditions to be added to this document before I sign it, which I'm hoping you make a condition of the approval of the development today. I asked for the documents to be updated 4 months ago. My house will be most affected out of any in Angel Street, so I need something in writing to confirm there will be some changes to lessen the impact. Originally, there were 42 car spaces. This has been reduced to 40. They were told to reduce the size of development. Instead, they have reduced the number of parking spots. This means the developer originally thought for this size block, it needed more parking. There was a reason this number was decided upon. This is now the bare minimum car spots allowed for this type of property, which isn't acceptable. How can 3 1-bedroom, 8 2-bedrooms, and 17 3-bedrooms, meaning 70 bedrooms, fit into 40 car spaces? They can't. The offload will park on the street, therefore causing traffic issue. Where will approximately 30 other people park? It will make it a one-way street. If you had a boat trailer or a caravan parked on the street and another car on the other side, you would not be able to get through. If a fire truck had to get through, they wouldn't be able to. This is a safety risk. Why can't the complex be reduced and make space for more cars to be parked on the property? By you allowing the development to go ahead, the parking, traffic, pollution and noise will turn Angel Street into chaos. I bought this house knowing it was a quiet, family-friendly street. I want to protect the safety of my family. It was stated in the last meeting, a traffic safety audit under the Australian Road guidelines has not been carried out to establish the best location and geometry for access to the development. How has this been looked into when the traffic counters were nowhere near the driveway for the proposed development? No other streets were looked at, and it also hasn't taken into consideration the driveway 30 metres up the road for the approved 41 Angel Street development. The developer has looked at where he wants the access and is not satisfied carrying out what has been asked to be looked at. The traffic counters were incorrectly placed in the street. Therefore, I object to these findings and needs to be redone. What about the cars that skip one of the two entries and go up Uli Avenue or Caroline Street? Therefore, people could be driving along Angel Street but miss the traffic counters because they were incorrectly placed. It has been stated that Angel Street South location is classified as a local street major because its carriage width is 10.5 metres. This is the very end of the street, not where the development will take place. Therefore, traffic counters should have been placed on the corner, outside where the development will be going. It would be classified as a local street minor because the carriageway is definitely not 10.5 metres. Individuals coming out of the entry and exit driveway of the development will be going onto a local street minor and then into a major street at the end, hence showing this area will be over the maximum daily traffic threshold because it will be 1,000 vehicles per day as per the council development control plan. It was stated there was no safety risk presented when looking into the best location for the entry and exit point. There are photos that have been taken, but there is no cars in this photo, hence why there is a better line of sight towards the other direction. Putting all these cars into this area and parking on the street, this will not be the case. Therefore, safety risks do arise and will be present because cars are blocking and preventing a clear line of sight. The average speed across
That's
the street...
5 minutes, so if you can sum up, please.
Yep. The average speed across the street is approximately 30 kilometres per hour when it is a 50-kilometre street. This shows how slow people need to go already, with the traffic regularly becoming a one-way street. Adding more cars to this scenario is ridiculous. The developer has not fixed the problems that were brought up at the last meeting. If anything, his solutions have added more problems.
Thank you. Can I just ask you a question?
Yeah.
This documentation appears to relate to headlights into your bedroom coming out of the driveway.
Yeah.
Yet, when we're on site, the windows opposite the... in your house, opposite the driveway, are the windows to the garage.
Yeah, so I'm talking about the view, the headlights. They're going to be that, the horizontal headlights or the beams from the sides will be hitting my front bedroom. If they turn left, that's going to be straight into my... If they turn left, it's going to be straight into my bedroom window.
Okay, but it's not directly opposite the driveway, it's... somewhat 20 metres away or thereabouts.
Yeah, but that driveway is going to become level. So when it comes, it's going to be coming the whole way through.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I understand.
All right, cheers.
Okay, the next speaker...
Sorry. The next speaker is Michelle Morton.
Hello, thanks for having us again. I'm resident of 24 Henry Street. Block B of the development is 6 metres from my back fence. Just on the point of traffic, it just took me 30 minutes to get from Tarrawonna to here because I couldn't get out onto the Northern Distributor. So to say that that area can take extra people is just ridiculous. I've read the amendments. I can see no significant changes to the original plan. I'm extremely disappointed to see that Council recommends approval of this development. The amendments demonstrate that council and the developer have paid no attention to significant concerns of residents, the people who live there, and the people that will be impacted daily. I'm unsure of the benefit of community consultation, other than to give the impression that the community is being heard. I find it ludicrous that the removal of parking spaces is seen to be appropriate when there's been no change to the number of units in the complex, and that all along parking provision was a major issue. To say that there are no safety issues with the positioning of the driveway and that Angel Street can easily manage the increased traffic is just ridiculous. A visual inspection of the area is enough to tell you straight away it's inappropriate. With regards to the blackbutt tree, two arborist reports state that the basement encroachment is between 11 to 13%. The Australian Standard states the maximum threshold is 10%, but still the council landscape officer states it's permissible as it's only a minor encroachment. I don't understand. What's the point of a standard if it's not going to be adhered to? Why should the developer be given so many exceptions to the rules? Which leads to my final point. I'm wondering what other exceptions council has given this development to get it through and that we're not aware of. Since early November, the privately owned land adjoining the council grazing land has been mowed by council employees on three separate occasions. I queried this with council maintenance and was advised it was done as a goodwill gesture to the residents. As one of those residents, I'm very grateful that they have taken it upon themselves to tidy up behind us. But I'm very confused as to why the owner of this land was not asked to maintain it, as any other ratepayer would be, a question I'm sure many ratepayers would like to know. It also concerns me that the developer states measures will be put in place to protect the blackbutt tree, but they are unable to complete the most basic mowing of their own land. It's Christmas. I urge you to throw a bit of goodwill and Christmas cheer the residents' way and reject this unsuitable development. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is Mr. Geoffrey Irwin.
What a day.
You're smiling. Does that mean you're happy?
I'm always happy.
Well, that's good to hear.
It doesn't matter what goes on here.
Well, I hope you don't really think that.
My apologies, I'm referring to me. I mean, you people make the decisions and we make our proposals, I guess, and that's if they're worthwhile. Just a couple of extra things. The southern section of, in terms of traffic, the southern section of Angel Street, speed limit's 50, but when I come out of my driveway, I have to estimate what these people are doing. And that, at times, is a racetrack, okay? And next-door neighbour has had an accident coming out of the driveway. Next thing on the list is in relation to the trees. The revised plan or discussion on the trees is really no different. The only thing that's significant is that there has been an effort to retain tree number 18 by modifying the development for that. How badly the pruning affects it or the tree roots, which they do, it takes a while for it to recover. But essentially the same number of trees are being replaced, although, granted, there are 10 trees which are theoretically to be placed in that area. A little point of issue, number 46 tree was supposed to be removed. It's not on this revised plan, so I don't know what happened to that one. Some trees which are being removed naturally in the situation where they, what do you call them? Beyond repair or something like that. Okay. My main concern is in terms of the floodplain that exists, okay? Between Block A and Block B is a riparian zone, if I remember correctly, that right, which is also a floodplain area. On the detailed site plan with Block A and AB, it lists three levels, one, two, three. The print's a little bit small for me to read. but whichever way you look at it, there is flooding which takes place on this particular area, and the residents themselves will always have to deal with this problem of flooding. And in the long term, if you have strata management or something like that, it's going to be an added cost or burden to people living in those in that particular area. Admittedly, there's retaining walls and et cetera, sort of to protect the buildings. But all these little blue, light blue, dark blue, red dotted lines come very, very, very close to Block A, Block B, or Block A, Block B, and the dwelling, if that can be acceptable, that's an interesting thing. There's a note, there was a note made about clearing the area of flood debris. You can keep this area clear of flood debris, but upstream, it won't. All that debris is going to come down. There isn't any question about it. Years ago, I used to have 1.5, 2 meter diameter tree about 10, 15 meters long across the back of Angel Creek as a walkway for my children to go and walk up and down the creek. Now, a lower level flood took that out. And with the, was that 1996, the one that we had? The
98.
Thank you. That took that tree completely away. Now, that was a massive tree. Now, you're going to have debris coming into this area. And where the first bridge is, it is a very narrow and deep creek. It all comes into this very narrow and deep creek. So there isn't any question about whether debris will block it up or not. But it's a matter of opinion. So overall, very simply, I should mention also at the same time an angel before Angel, the Angel Ferry Bridge, Angel Creek Bridge, the walkway that was built there was also washed away with the floods. I also mentioned that previously. They have built another one. It took nearly 2 years or 3 years before that was actually completed. We'll see how that survives in the long term. But in in the long term, the residents can expect that they can have their own private islands when the floods come along here. It's not a problem. It's inevitable, and I cannot see how this extensive building for Block A, Block B, and a residential building can actually really coexist comfortably. I don't know what resident... Well, residents will buy it if it's cheap enough, yeah, and then complain later on. Who's responsible in the long run for the flooding which takes place and destroys property? That's the big question. I think the council sort of says, no, that's it. Don't bother about it. And as a final little statement, I forgot to bring the printout here, but as far as development is concerned, you may know, you probably already know that there's been an extension approved, I forget, 17 metres on the Warragamba Dam. An extension has been an extension of the height of the Warragamba Dam has been approved by the New South Wales government. That will then flood the heritage sites. I don't know how many hectares in it, will flood the heritage sites which already exist, which means flora, fauna, whatever it is. And at the same time, downstream, there's then land available for development which was flood prone. So, whichever way you go, the trend seems to be approved development. And just let's see what happens, what residents can do after they've brought their property and things like that. Again, is pretty much debatable nowadays. I don't know the rules and regulations. Do you know when those sort of things are done as a question?
My understanding is that, and the applicants will be able to speak to this better, but okay, my understanding is that the development, and indeed all developments, have to, all new developments have to comply with the flood rules, which means that you cannot have a building which is less than the 1 in 100 year flood level. In this case, I think the buildings are actually, the ground floors are at the probable maximum flood, so they're actually higher than the 1 in 100. And the reason that I'm sort of responding to this, and I'm not an engineer, but I do have a lot of experience in working in flood-prone areas. And I was rather concerned as well about this development initially. However, and particularly the fact that, as you mentioned, Block A and Block B will essentially be islands in a flood. Mm-hmm. But the how it's been explained to me is, and I'm understanding more and more the flooding in Wollongong, is that the flood comes very quickly and dissipates very quickly. So if you're on the downstream side of Warragamba Dam, the flood takes about a week to get to you and can take a week to go away. In this case, it's gone within a couple of hours. So if people are isolated on islands, my understanding from the council engineers is that there's no particular issue with that because it complies with all of the council's requirements for flood zones. Well,
it's a pretty violent flood.
Can I just say, I was asked a question, I've answered the question. Applicant will speak more, but what I can say is that this has been assessed by council's engineers and it complies with the council's flood policy. Otherwise, they wouldn't be recommending approval.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
I've studied that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next speaker is Robin Deeds.
So I'm actually a community representative on other Wollongong local planning panels, but I'm speaking today as a member of the public and I'm not speaking as a community representative. I'd like to state from the start that I'm not anti-development. I'm actually in favour of sensible, appropriate development that helps build a community in a positive way. However, I'm disappointed that Council and the panel have chosen to dismiss the concerns of existing residents when we have said that this unit development is inappropriate for the site and the area generally. There have been no other unit developments anywhere nearby approved by Council. There is a Department of Housing unit block nearby which didn't need Council approval, and these are the only units built in the vicinity. So it appears to me that Council's previous vision for the area did not include the building of units a kilometre from the centre of Corrimal. Perhaps Council should listen to the wishes of the existing residents as to what type of environment and community they wish to live in. This development doesn't fit in with the single detached houses and villas in the immediate area. It is also proposed to be built on an inappropriate site, being a floodplain near the junction of Angel and Taroji Creeks. And I may have read the plans wrongly, but I thought the habitable floor level of Block B doesn't comply with the 1 in 100 plus 500 millimetre minimum floor level. But I might have read them wrong. It is true that Block A complies, but do people really want their yard and garden to regularly become flood affected? The road safety audit for the development only looked at where the driveway joins Angel Street. it didn't address whether the location of this driveway will be safe with respect to the driveway location of the council-approved 21 Villa development on number 41 next door, which is also proposed to be located on the same bend in the narrow road. It didn't look at safety along the narrow street where all additional cars, boats, caravans and trailers that don't fit in the car park of the development will need to park. I realise the parking provided within the development complies with the council DCP. However, the reality is that most families or even couples have two cars, and as children get older, even more than two cars. Angel Street can't cope with the overflow that will result from this development. Council can say that if parking isn't provided within the development, then people won't have as many cars and will use public transport, but this isn't the reality. The traffic study and road safety audit should have looked at the number of cars parked in Angel Street in the early morning before people leave for work or late at night when parking is at a premium. I believe council should consider the special limitations of the narrow street and insist on more on-site parking for the development. This is the fourth WLPP meeting I have attended. Each time there has been at least one development designed by ADM architects on the agenda, all with requests to greatly vary the standards and all with neighbours objecting to the development. Does ADM always push for so many variations that the development becomes unacceptable to the community?
Yeah, I think you might want to be careful about what allegations you're making there. It's... I mean, ADM is an applicant for a number of applications, and whether or not they are asking for variations, I mean, they're entitled to ask for them.
Yes.
Whether they get them or not is quite another thing. But excuse me, can we have some quiet, please? This lady's speaking, and I'm engaging in a conversation with her.
Okay, I won't say any more
about
that.
But you just need to be careful not to cast aspersions.
Okay. I note that council will have legal access over the development driveway so that they can mow the reserve. How will the public gain access to this part of the reserve? Will they have to battle through the bush and across the creek from Angel Street? Or will the cleared part of the reserve not be used so that council will then decide to sell it off because no one uses it? As I've said before, I'm not anti-development. I'm all for quality development in the appropriate location with developers who are honestly working with and listening to the surrounding residents. I believe Coram will need some development such as the Cokeworks and the Verge. That type of development will enhance the area by changing the mix of people in the suburb and stimulating the local economy. However, building a block of units on flood-prone land a kilometre from the centre of Coromel, and in doing so, creating parking problems for a quiet, family-oriented area will bring only negative impacts to the community. The only positives will be that the developer gets to put a lot of money in his pocket and the architect...
That's 5 minutes. If you'd like to sum up, that's 5.
That's all.
Thank you very much. That's the last speaker I have registered of submitters. Is there anybody else who wished to speak who didn't register?
Yes.
Yep. If you could come forward and start with your name and address, please.
Yep. My name's Bob Martin. I live at 19 Angel Street, Coromel. My comments are going to be more just based on the whole process of development applications. Not just this one, as Robin said,
Before you start, we're not here to review the process of development applications.
Okay, no, I can understand,
we're here to make a decision about this particular development application.
Fine.
Issues about process you need to be taking up with the council.
Okay, well, I should move that
generally.
Sign there where it says maintain integrity and earn trust and treat customers as we would want to be treated.
Did you listen to what I just said?
I just did. And that's,
you need to be taking this up with the council if you believe
so
that they're
the
not
problem,
meeting their charter.
Don't speak over the top of me
because you won't get respect by speaking
me. And I'm not looking for respect or anything like that. It just appears odd that these applications go to council, there's flaws with them, they've been approved, and then it's up to like ratepayers, the people in the community, the customers, to actually then come in and hold the council to maintain like a proper standard. It just seems like an odd way of doing things. And then what happens is you've seen here already, there's been a number of cases that have come in tonight where people don't bother turning up anymore. So this just seems to be, it's a bit of lip service in a way, as Michelle said, that we all just sit here and everyone nods and there's, you know, agreement and all that type of stuff, off it goes, and eventually the development's done. And that's all. I'd just like to make, because I was just sitting there, I wasn't even going to say anything tonight, but I just saw those things there, and it irks me as a customer that you, as a customer, I have to come in and top of do council's work for them, type of thing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who didn't register? Thank you. If you'd come forward and just before you speak, I'm going to respond to the last speaker. Sir, I don't know which agenda you read, but and whether you were here at the last panel meeting. Were you here at the last panel meeting? I was here. I chaired it. And I read the agenda, and my agenda says that last time the panel listened to the concerns of the community and we asked the applicants to make amendments.
I've got no problem.
Excuse me, I'm speaking.
Okay.
I didn't interrupt you. No. We've asked the applicant to make amendments based on some of the concerns that were raised, and we've asked the applicant, particularly based on the traffic concerns, to do a traffic safety audit. Now, the applicant's done all of that. They've come back here and they're asking for approval. They're saying that we've done what the panel asked us to do. The panel asked them to do that based on community concerns. So, sir, it's very sad that you think coming here is a waste of time. Thank you. Excuse me, you've spoken. Next speaker, please. Sir, it's not a debate. Will you sit down?
No, I didn't have the problem with the panel. I've got no problem with you.
Well, we're making the decision, not the council. Sir, it's not a debate. Please sit down. You've had your say.
You're making it into one.
I'm not making it into a debate. Look, you made a particular allegation. I'm saying that I'm very sad that you think it's a waste of time coming here, because we're here the second time because we've listened to the community the first time. So I'm not quite sure what you're listening to. Thank you.
Can I just add something? The development isn't approved. There's no decision been made. We're here tonight to make the decision. So that suggestion that it's been already decided is incorrect.
Thanks, Sue. Please proceed.
I'm Sharon. I live in 31 Angel Street, have done for 23 years. It's always been a great street to live in. It's a very attractive street. It has a green corridor in the street and behind on where the creek is. It's also a very quiet street. It's what my concerns are, and I'll just come to the point, is the traffic particularly will be a nightmare. The parking will be a nightmare. We're already at the total capacity, I believe, already in the street for parking. Most people have two cars. I will admit we have three. I have three daughters, so they have a car. We have two. So if you look at that, the roll on from that, three or four cars to a home in the street is not unusual. So my other point also is that exiting Angel Street onto the highway, one of my daughters had a horrific accident a number of years ago. It is a very difficult street to turn onto the highway turning right. I'm here really to make that very clear. It is a very dangerous exit point. She nearly lost her life, okay? Just want to just tick that off. Exits Henry Street, exit Angel Street, it's a very, very tight turn. I've been gone over many times. It's a dangerous point. It needs to be either straightened out, which you can't do, or nothing happens at all. You hear them going past my home. My home's about four doors up from where it turns. You can hear people hitting the brakes to go around that corner when they're not expecting it. It's not clear that street does bend so significantly. And also, when you do go up the other part of Angel Street from that bend, The parking there is at its capacity. It's very difficult for two cars, if at all, to get past. I usually go down there quite often. I often have to pull over every time, all the way up, to get down that street efficiently. And then there's another bend at the other end. It's not a very safe street to have a lot of cars going to and from on a daily basis. With the traffic safety audit, what I did notice was where the rat run is from the highway down Angel Street, down Carolyn Street, there was nothing, there was no audit there. That is a very, very busy rat run through there. Also, Yule Avenue, which is opposite me, that wasn't also, that information was not collected. It is a very, it can be a very busy street in the mornings and the evenings, but they are rat runs. During the day, it's fairly quiet, but during the evening, it is a rat run through there. And that was, that capacity was not audited as well. Parking's done. Flooding is a concern. I was there in the 98 flood where we were. It came quite significantly up. Why I remember it was we were putting extension on. We had a very deep, we had a swimming pool basically in our backyard and we had to pump it out. So I know how bad it gets there. I know that it was a significant flood then. Isn't to say that that won't happen, because one in a 100-year flood could be one every 20 years if you're, you know, we know that. It's just that that's how it's, I mean, in my past I was an environmental scientist. I know how this works. So you can have that sort of flood more often than one in 100 years. So we've had, what, 20-plus years now. It could happen, you know, another any time soon, I think. It could happen again. That's the reality. So I think that's all I'd like to say, but I wasn't completely aware that it hadn't been completely approved as well. I thought it had been. From the readings I had done, my feeling was that it's been ticked off as approved. This is really not a building that's going to really work in our area. It's just too big for the site. We are a kilometre from the city of Corrimal, or the town of Corrimal. It's single dwelling houses. It's going to poke up. You're going to be able to see it. You're going to be experiencing it. But also the exit points, everything into Angel Street. I don't understand why we cannot have another exit point somewhere else, whether it's Henry Street or somewhere else. I just think it's very unfair that we have to cater for all the traffic into that site from Angel Street at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just clarify something with regard to what the one in 100-year flood means? That means that there's a 1% chance of that flood occurring in any year. It doesn't mean that it's likely to be one every 100 years. So your point is well made. You could actually have 100 1% floods in a year, or you could have none in 100 years.
Thanks, Sue. For the applicant, we have the architect, Mr. DiMartino. We have Mr. Adrian Bitsios, the traffic consultant. Certainly there's some matters that we'd like you to respond to. We have a tree person here, an arborist, and also Mr. Treglown, planner. So normal thing, 5 minutes each, but... And obviously there's been a number of issues raised tonight, and the panel would be appreciative if you can respond to those issues and how the design takes account of some of those matters that have been raised. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'll just give a general overview of the changes and where we sit from a planning perspective, and then I'll lead into Adrian, the traffic engineer, and Warwick, the arborist, because there's probably quite a few questions in relation to that. In relation to the site, just to clarify some comments made today about perhaps the development being unsuitable on the site, this particular zone does allow residential low density, does allow residential flat buildings under council's LEP. The development is two storeys with basement parking, and sits within the permitted height restrictions. So there's no variation in terms of that. The development is also compliant in terms of floor space ratio. We have not sought to vary that standard. If you look at the site, it is a fairly significant site. The footprint that we're proposing on the site is quite low. Acknowledge that it is a difficult site in terms of site constraints, but the placement of the two separate buildings on the site endeavours to work within those site constraints, and the placement of the single dwelling adjacent to the street acknowledges that the streetscape currently is of single detached dwellings. The larger buildings are tucked much further back on the site. In relation to the car parking, the changes that we're proposing do adjust the basement level of Block A, and they adjust the basement level plus the upper levels of Block B. The adjustment to Block B was done to address the foreshore building line. The panel asked us to make sure we were totally outside of the foreshore building line, which we have achieved with the current design. There has been some reconfiguration of units at the upper levels in Block B. The units in Block A remain the same, with the basement changed to protect the roots of the tree. In relation to the parking numbers, Council's DCP is quite clear in terms of what parking is required, and that is Council's standard. Certainly, if Council believes that's an inappropriate standard, it would be appropriate for Council to amend its DCP. We are fully compliant with parking. Previously, we had one additional space for Block A and Block B, and we had an excess. In this particular case, we are fully compliant, and the Council report acknowledges that. In terms of the tree, I might lead into Warwick and the traffic. I might lead into Adrian from there to give any other comments. I'm happy to answer any other questions that you might have at this stage, though.
We have any questions for the planner?
Well, I suppose it is a sort of planning issue. Mm-hmm. There's a question raised, and to my mind a valid one, about how the public can gain access to the public land.
Which you're referring to the council land next door?
Yes, the council land, okay. Because it will be landlocked.
I believe there was some negotiations that occurred with council, and the applicant has indicated that they were happy for an access to be provided through this land. Yep, so that was negotiated with council.
So will the access be from Angel Street?
No, from the rear.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll talk. It was because it's not shown on the plans, is the issue.
No.
The site has, but not the public access. The public reserve.
Public reserve has a frontage.
Council had indicated it currently doesn't have clear access to its public reserve, so it negotiated with the landholder as to whether that could be provided. He agreed that that would be provided. Yeah, for maintenance purposes, I should say. Yeah. All right.
Okay, that's it, I think.
Okay. It's from the opposite building A. Oh, okay, opposite building A from the driveway, because I know there's some discussion at the back. Yeah.
So it's not landlocked. It's got frontage to Angel Street. You can't physically get across there, but it's not landlocked.
In terms of the access for council, the proponent provided a easement over the driveway and the gates to be in place to have access to the park for maintenance, which there isn't at the moment. Yep. So the proponent's providing that as part of the application.
That's my understanding of what's being provided. And we actually questioned the council officers about that, and they were satisfied with
and
that access.
That was part of one of the requests the officers had.
Yep. Thank you. We're not having a discussion here. People are speaking. You had the opportunity to speak. I don't know if you spoke, but that opportunity's finished now and we're listening to the applicant. Okay.
I've explored that issue.
The fact of the matter is that there's no public access now, and as a consequence of this development, the development in itself doesn't generate the need for public access, but the applicant has offered to provide it so the council can use it where it doesn't exist now. Thank you.
Okay, traffic.
Seems to be a big issue with the residents. So Well, we really need to understand more about your study and what you've measured and what you haven't measured and
Some of the reasoning behind it. And I think, that's already a key point, is understanding what we actually undertook and what we found through the investigation. So I'll just go back to the task that we had set in front of us. The task was spelt out in the paper. So it's to conduct a traffic safety audit under the guidelines of AusRoads to establish the best location and geometry for the access to the development. The other point that was made was that there was no actual traffic counts provided for Angel Street to properly establish the traffic impacts of the development. So when we received these two points, it was very clear that the first point related to the location of the driveway in terms of the sight lines from the driveway location, particularly considering the horizontal curves in the vertical crests along that section. And the second point that we took as being it's the traffic impacts associated from the development to, because it does say actual traffic counts have been provided for Angel Street to properly establish and put all the traffic impacts of the development. So normally that is the development on the adjacent intersections. So the reason why the location, and there's nothing there about speed, it's purely about, in terms of that second item, the traffic counts. And so the locations were chosen on the basis of understanding the incremental increase this development places in terms of trip generation on those intersections at either end, so the outlets. So when the trips get out onto Angel Street and they try and get to the main road network, being Tarrawonna Road and Princess Highway, based on the approach volumes that we've captured at either end, so there was a count taken to the west of Andrew's Place and a count taken to the east of Caroline Street. So it's either end. Basically, it's the approach to the intersections. The point was made, I think, from one of the... And another resident did pick up as well, a very good point, in that you'll see that the difference in the volumes at the western end at Andrew's Place, there are only 355 vehicles a day. You move to the eastern end of Caroline Street and they're up at 1,184. So there's definitely... and that local catchment does not generate 800 trips a day. So there is a rat run issue. Most likely, coming just based on my local knowledge, from Underwood Street, coming through from Corrimal back through the back streets, down Caroline Street, turning left, getting down Angel Street to head south. That's coming back. So I suspect that's a fair way away from where we're located. In terms of the count at west of Andrew's Place, there's no other, between the driveway location and that count site, there's actually no other intersecting street. So there's the only additional traffic above that 355 vehicles a day would be the houses that reside between that count location, that being Andrew's, the residents of Andrew's Place and the residents along Angel Street to that driveway location. So it's very unlikely that the volumes would get anywhere close to that 1,000 threshold. And even though that 1,000 threshold set for that road carriageway width, it's not a black and white number. Many locations have volumes that exceed the theoretical threshold of a carriageway, and typically what happens is you provide traffic calming to manage those speeds and keep traffic safe. There are obviously levels well above that start to introduce other issues that make that volume too high. But certainly it's not a black and white on that number, and I don't believe we're anywhere near that number in that regard in any case. In terms of...
Yeah.
So seasonalities. We also do a lot of traffic modelling, we analyse data a lot across a lot of models. We've built the city centre model for Wollongong for RMS, the Wollongong City Centre model. We do a lot of modelling around town, and we normally seasonally adjust the traffic volumes in a residential area like what we're talking about. At best, you're looking at 10% increase in seasonality. If you're looking at somewhere like down in Hobart where you've got holiday homes and the likes and the transient populations coming in the summer to go fishing and the likes, it's totally different. Yeah, you'll get 100% annualisation factor. But certainly in residential pockets in somewhere like Wollongong in this area, it would be at best 10%. So even on the numbers of 355 at 10%, you're still, plus the additional residents, plus the 10% annualisation, it's still not of a significant number. And to put it in the context, the development's got in the order of 28 units. It generates in the order of 14 trips in the peak. What we typically do in terms of distribution is of that, 10 would be heading out in the morning peak and 4 would be coming back in. So we're talking 10 trips going out of the driveway in the peak hour, which is one vehicle every 6 minutes. And if you're to stand on the side of the road, one vehicle every 6 minutes. And I understand, like if I lived in the area, I'd be feeling the same thing. But as the job that we do as traffic engineers, we look at multiple sites across multiple locations, and we see various size and scale of developments. And one trip per 6 minutes is not a significant number. It's quite a low number in the context of the street and the volumes that currently exist on that section.
What about streets without footpaths? Does that have any bearing on feeling safe or not feeling safe or being safe or not being safe?
Typically, streets with the volumes less than 1,000 are designed so that you can walk on the street. Knowing this council area as well, having done a lot of work in this area for the last 10, 15 years, there are a lot of grassed verges, and council just typically don't have the funds to put footpaths everywhere. And it would be a pointless exercise for this applicant to provide a footpath along this frontage and then it connects to nowhere. I mean, it really needs to be continuous as part of a broader strategy to have the footpath connections, because it's potentially making it worse because you're leading someone to walk to somewhere where there's no other facility either side. So I'm not sure and to be honest, that wasn't really in the scope of what we were assessing. Going back, the two conditions that we've been asked to look at, or the two questions, was the location of the driveway and the impacts, as we saw it, on the adjacent intersections. And we believe we've looked at those. Our road safety order, I'll move to the road safety order. I believe the counts have been addressed in terms of the impacts on the adjacent intersections.
Just in relation to the counts, one of the speakers, I think, was implying that your counts missed the busiest time in the evening. But I'm looking at your counts, and they are 24-hour counts.
No, I think it was the parking. And it was
the parking.
Yeah, it was the impact. The question was raised that the site inspection didn't occur in the morning, so the visualisation of the parking on street. It sounds like some of this may be an existing issue, if there's existing parking problems on the street in the morning. Conversely, though, when you look at the volume profile, which you've got there in front of you, before 8 o'clock in the morning and after 6 o'clock at night, the volumes really do dive away. Like, they do drop quite substantially. So from a risk assessment perspective, yes, there's cars. Yes, there's cars parked. Yes, there's cars travelling through. And some would say that performs a traffic calming function in its own right. You'll notice on the curves themselves, you'll notice there's a double barrier line. It's actually illegal to park within 3 metres of a double barrier line. So if cars are parking adjacent to the double barrier line, then that's something that should be taken up with council's rangers, because it's illegal to park within 3 metres of a double barrier line. And if it's still a problem, I mean, you can put down a yellow line to reinforce the no-stopping rule on those corners. So the issue of the parking on the corners or the bends to restrict visibility or adjacent to driveways, that can certainly be addressed through line marking. That's not a major issue, and that can come after a monitoring period, after the driveway's in place and everything else happens.
Your counters look like they measure the speed of the vehicles as well.
Yeah, well, you get it for free, basically. Yeah. So when you put the counts down, you get the speed as a subset.
I was just looking at the counts, and after hearing a couple of the speakers talk about speeding vehicles, I was quite surprised to see that the average speed's about 30 k's an hour.
Yeah, some of that is, I think one of the speakers did mention that the proximity to the intersection. So if you look at west of Andrews Place and east of Caroline Street, it is quite a short section between intersections. And if you are getting a lot of rat runners from Underwood Street and Caroline Street, then you potentially would be getting lower speeds as a result of that. So potentially not a data set to look at in too much detail. So agree with that. That was a very good pickup, whoever picked that one up.
I'm just looking, even at 1 o'clock in the morning, the average speed. Mm. No, sorry. When's the first car? There's no cars on that day. One day there was a car at midnight was travelling at 20 to 30. So
there
was no restrictions.
Yeah, in saying that wasn't the brief, I suppose.
No,
the brief was.
But it's just an interesting observation. Yeah. In relation to traffic speed?
Look, from it might be worthwhile going to the road safety, the second point, because yes, I might be able to address the speed issue as well a little bit. The road safety auditors that I wasn't the road safety auditor that conducted the audit. Two of our staff conducted the audit. I am a lead road safety auditor accredited under the RMS system. The two officers are lead road safety auditors. Alan Finlay has got over 40 years' experience, one of the most respected traffic engineers in the state, if not Australia. And Alex Gihahi's got in the order of 15 years' experience. So both very experienced engineers. They went to site, and the first thing that they noticed is it's on the outside of a curve. So in terms of driveway locations, that's probably the best scenario you can have. If you're on the inside of the curve, you have the site constraints. If you're on the outside of the curve, you've got full visibility of what's coming to you around the corner. So so that was the first thing that they did pick up. The second thing they picked up is that there's already curve warning signs in place with the advisory speeds of 35 kilometres an hour on those curves. Now, if motorists aren't conforming to those speeds, and they didn't observe any non-conformance, and they were there from mid-afternoon through to the evening, that's a compliance issue. That's an existing compliance issue. That's not to do with this development. Well, that's something that needs to be managed through City of Wollongong Traffic Committee. It happens everywhere. You get a proportion, and that's why we use the 85th percentile as our design speed, because there is a proportion that do the wrong thing, and you can't design everything for that 15%. So their findings were basically the tightness of the curves. It's difficult to actually travel fast through there, and it's on the outside of a curve. So they felt there was no need to adjust the driveway location. It was fine where it is, and compared to their years of experience, they couldn't see a reason not to allow the driveway to be in that location. Look, so that essentially addressed the two points that we were asked to address. I'm just trying to see if I've covered off on everything, which I believe
In which case, I'd just like to ask a question. Because there's an issue raised about the problematic access from Angel Street to Prince's Highway. Yes. I know that's beyond your brief,
yes.
But I would like advice on whether there's anything that could be done to deal with that would improve outcomes for existing residents and if there's increased traffic into the area.
Yeah, look.
Assist.
Again, so this is outside of my brief. I do a lot of work for Council RMS and all across the east coast of Australia. So I don't think I'm speaking out of turn in saying what I'm about to say. The issue of the traffic diverting, whether you want to call them rat running or diverting, potentially reducing that may assist. Essentially what happens a lot of these side streets where you get build up of traffic waiting to turn right, once you've got three or four or five or six cars behind you, you feel pressured to turn right because the queue is building behind you. So that's one of the aspects that need to be considered. The other aspect is as the through volumes continue to increase on the Princess Highway, it obviously becomes more difficult to turn right. Turning left's easy. And you'll see RMS doing it across the Wollongong network. They'll put turn restrictions in. So, look, a quick, simple solution would be to put a banned right turn during the peak period. The first thing that would have to occur would be to look at the crash data to see, is there a need for it? And that'd be the first thing that the agencies would normally do, is they look at the crash data. Is there a problem that we need to fix? And if there is a problem that they need to fix, then the simplest and cheapest and the most cost-effective would be to put a peak hour band right turn in. The longer-term strategy would be to have some sort of form of traffic management scheme over the whole section with a view of the whole section. So encouraging traffic potentially use Tarrawonna Road and to turn out at the signals opposite Stockland or the like. So just having a plan in place so that there are safe movements occurring to and from the main road network. But that really is a broader area traffic management planning exercise. But again, if there is a safety concern at that intersection, a peak hour band right turn is it's just a couple of signs and it's a quick fix. Yeah. That's okay.
Any other questions for the traffic? No? Thank you. That's okay. Were we going to hear from the arborist, I think?
Thank you. Primary concern was regarding tree number 18, which was requested to be retained and the Block A, I believe it is, redesigned to accommodate this tree. The architect and I, my colleagues, worked together. I basically gave them the minimum requirements as far as distances you can work from this tree, which conforms to approximately minor encroachment, and we worked around these grounds for the sake of retention of the tree. I knew at the same time there was, because the tree is a very broad sprawling tree, there was going to be potential issues with the crown mass on it. So again, we also attempted to provide a design which minimised the amount of pruning on the tree. Now the encroachment, and I believe as one of the speakers, Michelle Morley, picked up on the fact that it was considered a major encroachment based on the Australian standard of 4970. And, of course, this particular standard doesn't prevent development or encroachment greater than 10%, but what it asks for is evidence to show why this form of encroachment would not adversely impact on the tree. Now, as a general rule, we find since this standard's been introduced in 2009, is most councils comfortably accept encroachments, depending on the tree species, the health of the tree, comfortably 15, 16, 17%, without, because we understand it is an arbitrary root zone based on a formula, and pending the type of encroachment and the tree, it can be comfortably accepted, and it is across the board. Our background is as we've been in this industry for over 20 years, specialising in development work. A third of our work is state government. We cater for a great deal of work with councils, and we do a lot of council developments as well as those with Wollongong Council, Sydney councils. We're also asked to come in and review reports on behalf of council which have been submitted by other arborists. And it's what we see across the board are encroachments which can comfortably be accepted, which are ranging up around 15 to 17%. Without adversely affecting a tree, and we've got many examples of these, which we've seen developments provide these encroachments in years past without any adverse effect on the tree. And the same goes for the actual crown mass and the percentage of crown mass. Now, we have the actual standard does not specify a proportion of crown mass, and of course that really is dependent on the tree, but we have got the ISA, the International Society of Arboriculture's standards, which refer to a figure of around a 20% mark. Within their pruning guidelines, which are suggestive that pruning in excess of 20% can have an impact on the vitality. And, of course, hence the reason we nominate the proportion of crown mass which was as being removed and how much we could accommodate in that position. Did you have any further questions regarding...
Sue, did you have some questions?
I do... So first off, a lot of what you've said is dependent also on the species of tree
Certainly.
Involved. So what sort of data have been collected on impacts on black butts eucalyptus?
Look, in Australia, and you're probably familiar with the field of arboriculture, we have all of two textbooks which have ever been, actually three if you want to include the IACA dictionary, in Australia. All our textbooks and all our reference material is European, British and American. What we resort to, and because this is, I taught for 14 years, diploma, and one of the areas I always used to refer to my students was, you need to find reference material, but you're going to be very limited in Australia. So where we generally turn, and we were referring to eucalypts, for instance, I refer to the Department of Forestry. Now, I've got a reasonably strong background with them. I am the editor of the Eucalyptus Study Group, which is an international body, which is a subsidiary of the Australian Plant Society. I've been published in the area, and I'm reasonably familiar with them. And generally when we're looking at the tenacity of a species, what gives you a good indicator is its geographical distribution. And black butts have got a very broad geographical distribution. They're also a primary species used in the Department of Forestry. And they generally choose trees which are relatively tolerant and have good vitality. apart from their wood qualities. So answering that, and that experience, because we do a lot of work throughout the Illawarra, and it is a very dominant species throughout the Illawarra, we find them tolerant.
Right, okay. Now, my other question is, I just want to clarify, you're proposing to have the one, is it the entire limb back to the major, the main primary stem pruned, or just the portion of the limb, so it's a branching limb on the southern side?
My proposal in my addendum referred to the first order limb to the stem to conform to the Australian standard 4373. And I did that because I felt that removal of too much of the secondary branching is going to effectively, the predominant crown mass resides on the outside extremity. So by removing the predominant crown mass, you effectively could be running out of options for pruning back to branch collars. Secondly, you'll be leaving a limb which is reasonably denuded. And considering limbs are self-autonomous, that doesn't provide for a good outcome for the viability of that limb, and there's a good chance it would potentially naturally die back anyway.
Okay, so the point I was trying to have you clarify on behalf of the people concerned about the tree is the extent of the pruning that will be. Is it within 20% of the tree?
No, I think it's about 10 or 15% was nominated in my addendum. Mm.
I just want the community to appreciate. So the community should know that I too am a qualified arborist and 15. I'm well acquainted with the Australian standard, and I can interact very well with this sort of conversation we're having.
15%.
15%. Now, my other issue is, are you aware that there's an approved development on the adjoining property which will come also on the other side encroach to, and I don't know how to what extent. Did you look at the fact that the tree is also likely to be impacted from the other side?
I did. I had taken that in consideration, and there's the gully runs through beside that. Actually, the 50%, close to 50% of the tree protection zone extends into the culvert, the gully, I don't know, the watercourse, where they're not building, and there are backyards backing onto that area. There is a retaining wall extending virtually in a radial fashion from the fence line, but by the same token, it's because it's extending in a radial fashion, it has minimal impact on the actual root system, and it's backfilling, not cutting.
Thank you. So the other issue is trees, the age of the trees can affect their ability to withstand the impacts of development. Can you respond to that in relation to this tree?
Well, this tree, as much as it's large, is actually not a terribly old tree. Allowing for eucalypts, the generic lifespan of a eucalypt is around 400 years in the natural environment. Look, we have those which we know have been registered up to 600 and 800 years plus. In this particular circumstance, we can generally half that time span within the urban environment. This tree is not remnant based on its habit. I believe is actually reproduced from natural seed store there, and that's based on its habit, because if you look in the bush reserve, just as you're entering the property, that is natural bush reserve, and all the trees there are forest class, and they're black butts, and that's naturally how we see all the black butts, remnant black butts, throughout the urban environment.
Take that on board. Sorry to interrupt, but if it's regenerated from local seed, it is treated as a part of remnant vegetation.
What's
but
more relevant is the age we're referring to at the moment.
That's right. So it's a young tree, and it's grown in a particular habit. That the fact that it's a spreading tree with effectively a round circular canopy indicates that it didn't grow within a forest. It's
That's
grown
correct.
Within the open
space. The
area's
been cleared and it's reproduced. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So thank you for that. I don't have any other questions.
Thanks, sir. Any other questions?
Look, I have one question.
Brenda.
I suppose I'm looking at this site. As you know, I don't live here. I just looked at the site today. I've been studying this report. And I'm looking at this site as curiously isolated. but also that site next door that's public land that's currently inaccessible. And did you have any sort of any comment about that land and the quality of the vegetation on that land?
That's probably more the feel of an ecologist, but I actually did. We always include neighbouring trees in our reports, regardless, even if the survey doesn't include them, which is very common. We do that in any case, circumstance where a tree protection zone or potential tree protection zone can encroach into a property. Mm. We include those trees. Now, in this circumstance, there was a row of black butts, which where the tree protection zones encroached into the property. Where they are included in our report, they were part
of
the.
On the southern part of the site.
Yes, that's what
you're
referring to.
Where the driveway is.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And we made a call that we probably would likely need route mapping in that area, which we conducted that, and that was our first addendum, a route mapping exercise to show how much root system extended over there, and what type of impact that could have on the trees, pending the grades of the drive and the bridge.
It's such a phenomenal amount of infrastructure that's being proposed that if it were to be made more public, more publicly accessible, could you imagine that that would be a good sort of outcome, that you could actually access that public land?
I don't know if it's exactly an area for me to answer. I always think it's great for people to be able to enter areas which have trees in them, yes.
I think that's more a rhetorical question.
Okay.
Any other questions?
No.
No. Thank you very much. Mr. Molnar, did you want to say anything? Anyone else from your team that was registered? No? Okay. Question for?
I have a couple of questions that I thought should go for the architect or Angelo. Is Angelo going to talk?
Yeah.
I thought they were nodding, but saying no.
Yeah, I don't think he was intending to talk.
Oh, the way you weren't intending to talk. I just have a few questions.
He wouldn't feel right if you didn't.
No, if I didn't
give him some
you.
Sort of grilling.
Yeah.
I'll have to pull that battery out, Pierre.
Okay.
Anyway, Sue. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got a list of questions here that I just. First off, can you just talk to the access to the. Council reserve, just so that we all understand, because it currently can only be accessed from Angel Street if you go down a gully through thick vegetation, is that right?
Look, I think during the assessment process the council officers approached the proponent and said, you know, we would really like to get access for our machinery to be able to maintain that our land, because at the moment it's very difficult. So the proponent proposed a right-of-way or an easement over the driveway with a gate that they would be able to basically get their machinery into the reserve and maintain it. So that's part of the DA approval, I would imagine.
So, in other words, if council decides that it should be open to the public generally for some form of use, it would be up to council to provide separate access.
Correct.
To the reserve. Okay.
Yeah, my understanding was that that was briefly discussed, but there were very difficult implications regarding liability over private property, and it doesn't exist at the moment. So what we're doing is, well, what the proponent is proposing is a betterment of the existing situation to assist council to service their land, but it's not public access. It's for maintenance purposes. Yeah.
Thank you. So now I just want to address some of the flooding issues that have been raised.
Okay, well, I'm an architect, but I'll try.
Well, it's in terms of how you've designed your building in relation to the flood risks. So did the flood assessment that you relied on address potential the modelling that deals with the potential sea level rises
predicted? I'm not an expert. All I understand is that last time we did have our... And I know that not all the panel members were the same members. There was questions directed to the stormwater engineer who was here last time. He answered the questions and
you know, council officers have again, engineering officers have supported the application. That's all I can really say. I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert in whether their modelling included the sea level rise. I just can't honestly answer that question for you.
Yeah. So we then need to ask council whether their stormwater engineer took that into account.
I would imagine the modelling today would have to do that, but yep. I could not answer that question. You know.
Okay. Yep. So I then want to look, is the basement going to be below the flood, predicted flood lines you've drawn on your map? So the residential portion is not within the
normally,
1 in 100 year flood line.
Normally the basements are accessed above the flood line, so that essentially a basement is underground, but the theory is the water doesn't enter the basement because the entry to the basement is above the flood level.
I do recall asking this question last time about the basements. What stops the
There was a lot of discussion last time, Sue, on flood.
Because the level of the basement might be below the 1 in 100.
That's correct.
But the water
can't get it. And look, it's common and it's done. Yeah. It's actually done elsewhere. Like,
look, I'm asking these questions just to be absolutely clear so that the community with their concerns understands that how it's tackled and how what we're dealing with. So
I understand.
So what measures have you put in place with regard to how high a barrier will it be in a serious flood event to prevent the basement flooding?
The barrier itself is the level, because the level itself is the maximum probable flood. So all levels, habitable levels, are 500 above. Is it 500 or a metre? Andrew's the chief engineer here. but the driveway, I think, is allowed to be a little bit lower than the habitable level, but again, still above the flood level, the maximum probable flood. So there's the actual flood level, and then there's the maximum probable flood level, which is higher, and then there's another higher level, and we work to the highest level. It's just across the board. It's a fairly strict regime. So.
And thank you.
Yep.
So, and do you have in place measures to pump out the basement should it happen to get flooded?
There usually is a pump, but it's not meant to pump out flood water. It's just
to drain the flood water.
The assumption is that the flood water doesn't enter the basement, but any water that does enter the basement, there is a pump to. To pump the water out, But look, I'm not, 100% on these answers because I'm the architect, not the civil engineer.
So with regard to the design of the building, my final concerns relate to the actual building. So first off, our plans don't have the residential dwelling shown on them. Is that not a part of this application? We don't have the details of the elevation.
There is a residential dwelling at the front, and that was, I would take that up with the officers.
Yeah, in the plans. We've only got it on a site plan.
No, there are floor plans and elevations and sections of the dwelling.
Thank you.
As part of the application.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll check that.
And there is also a perspective that we did after the client, the proponent spoke to the community and they wanted to know what it looked like from the street. So there's a 3D artist impression of it as well.
So then finally, I looked at your that you're providing communal open space really at ground level around the buildings, both Building A and Building B, but I have concerns about the ease of access to that. And with regard to the communal open space at the southern end of Building B, there are a few steps down to it. Could that be conditioned to be a ramp so that it's fully accessible?
I believe there's universal access, but if you want to condition that, that's fine.
I'm just concerned, Anjo, that to get a wheelchair to that part, you've got to go out front and right around the building because there are steps shown on the plans to it.
I don't recall there being steps. There shouldn't be steps. There should be universal access.
Okay.
So
we'll look
that's
at that
fine to condition that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Brendan?
No, I don't really have any questions about the buildings themselves, except to say that
by splitting up the buildings and showing them without context, I think you've opened up a lot of fear and uncertainty to the local community. You don't know. You probably can't see from your drawings that the buildings are actually very low, probably lower than their roofs.
They're two-storey, yeah. They're
surrounded by trees. Mm. That can't be seen in the documents. So...
We provided.
Well, I'm sitting here trying to draw sections myself to establish how the buildings are, like both of them on the one drawing.
Fair enough.
And how they come up to the streets. And I think that actually exacerbates a lot of fears that people cannot see what the relationship between your buildings and their community is like. And I'd say that's a great error. The other thing is, and I would sort of repeat it, you know, whether it's impossible or not, that the fact you're making, it's a very wide block. The community at the moment are thinking, well, all you're doing is taking. But in fact, it's on a very large site that is able to be developed like this. But in terms of giving back, sure, you're providing access to the council, but it looks to me as though instead of this thing being called a driveway, it's actually like a sort of mews that someone can walk through or ride a bicycle across. That's actually a great advantage for somebody to be able to move across the site to access school or whatever, on a bicycle or walking, and at the same time walk alongside public lands. Like you've said, that suggestion immediately raises issues of public safety and council don't want to go there. Well, perhaps then the community need to know that if that were to change, you'd be open to it. Because I just wonder, you know, the planning process has got everything to do with doing things the best way you can, and I think you are trying to do things the best way you can, but also take advantage of opportunities to engage with the public domain, to actually provide opportunities. And one of them is linking. Like, these are very big blocks, you know. The idea, this exacerbates problems of traffic when people can't easily just move from that street to that street by alternative means. So I am sort of interested, the way it's been designed at the moment, there's a fence along it. I don't quite know what the fence is for. There's a footpath, but then the footpath stops and then it turns into, well, it's sort of like buffer planting. But it's linking a council reserve and a public street. So, you know, it's probably impossible, but I actually think it might be good for your development to keep open the possibility that driveway could be considered more like a lane. It might be a private lane, but it has a footpath. And there is this possibility that people can cross that space. I don't know. It might be something that, as an opportunity, you shouldn't be so quick to close down.
We did consider it. It wasn't other, something that we closed
boundary,
down. You know.
On the other boundary, there's an approved development that can't but be all about itself. It's simply sitting there amongst the watercourses and the trees and what have you. Your boundary actually faces a block of land that's currently public that has a great many trees and it crosses creeks. You're building bridges. And it would seem as though it's not too far away from saying, and it can provide access, you know. And I think it's a bit of a shame, and probably a shame for the local community, that's not included in your thinking.
Thank you, Brendan.
Okay, nothing further. Thank you, Mr. DiMartino. That concludes item four, and that concludes the agenda for tonight. As I mentioned earlier, after the meeting's closed, the panel will deliberate and make its decisions. Those decisions will be published on the council's website, usually within 3 working days. So I'll close the meeting formally at 6:56 p.m. Thank you.